It doesn't matter who we are, change happens.
I flatlined.
Sometimes it's forced on us.
You know there's more than one baby here.
Sometimes we choose it.
There's a time where you just need to jump.
But when it happens, it changes everything.
I just stopped the drugs on the Sunday.
So how do we respond to it? Join me, Ruda Landman, to explore that in our podcast, When Change Happens. Listen at changepodcasts.co.za.
The wind whistles through the vineyard's rustling leaves. The ground crunches underneath their feet as they move toward the farmhouse. The cover of night helps mask them as they put their plan into action. Within minutes, four gunshots will ring out, a defining moment for the men and their victims. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 165, The Murder of Alberto Costa. This episode is sponsored by Solal. If you've been a True Crime South Africa listener for a while, or you follow the show on social media, you'll know that the last 5 years have been a wild ride for me. It's been amazing, and I am incredibly grateful for all the opportunities, but going from being a sales manager in a 9-to-5 to being a podcaster and the author of 3 true crime books in such a short space of time has often left me feeling exhausted. In 2022, when I received my first book contract for Samurai Sword, I had about 3 months to write the book. I was also still running the podcast and doing freelance writing for a few clients at the time. It was insane. And I will admit that I came very close to pretty much totally burning out at the time. So when Solal approached me to talk about a sponsorship on the podcast, it was a no-brainer for me, because it was actually one of their products that helped me through that period. I came across Solal's Burnout Adrenal Support product during that time, and it made an incredible difference. Solal's Burnout Adrenal Support has a mix of herbal ingredients that will help with tired adrenal glands, extreme fatigue, chronic fatigue syndrome, stubborn weight gain, mild depression, and stress from certain situations or stressful jobs, which I think is a pretty good description of mine. I used the product for about 6 months in 2022, and it really helped me to get through that time. I haven't had a need for it again since then, thankfully, but I've recommended it to a bunch of my friends, and they've all benefited from using it. One thing I really like about Solal, which I noticed on their burnout product, was that they specifically say you should take a 2-week break between courses. This really made me feel like the company isn't just out to push product, but they're actually concerned about the well-being of their customers. Solal has a wide range of products to help promote physical and mental well-being, so there'll undoubtedly be one that suits your needs. You can view their product range on their website at solal.co.za or check out their products at any one of their multiple stockists. A huge thank you to Solal for sponsoring this episode. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Emmy Dorcas Wawira, Michaela Mann, Julia Trudeau, and Wallace for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout out on the pod, and other exclusive content, including Q&As with me as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please, and thank you. Kia ba.
Murders during home invasions are unfortunately far too common in South Africa, and they often remain unsolved, despite more often than not there being some connection, even though tenuous at times, between the victims and the perpetrators. Often the link is an employee of the victims, sometimes an individual who's been inside their home to carry out some form of contract work. And occasionally, the link is just that the victims live and work in the same community and are well known. Home invasions and robberies like this in suburbs are far more common during the day, when victims are less likely to be at home, as are their neighbours. When the properties targeted are more rural, though, on small holdings and farms, it's unlikely there'll ever be a time when there's no one at home or on the property. And so, those home invasions will often happen at any time of the day. In addition, the intentions of the perpetrators often change the ultimate result of home invasions. As we've seen through various cases of this nature over the years, some individuals will break in with the sole desire of getting as much loot as they can and leaving, and they want the crime to be as clean as possible. No blood spilled and no complications. But other perpetrators either set out with the intention to get information like PIN numbers from their victims, which of course requires interaction and creating an atmosphere of fear, and a few offenders just don't care either way. They want what they've come for, and they're more than prepared to kill to get it. Tracking and arresting these individuals is not always easy, and I think most members of the public would be surprised at the tactics employed in the background to secure arrests in such cases. My sources for this episode include the book Stellenbosch Murder Town by Julian Janssen, as well as several media and other web-based sources. So let's get into episode 165, The Murder of Alberto Costa.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Alberto Costa was born in Paarl on the 2nd of May 1966. Although he was born in South Africa, his family was originally from Morestica in Italy. Alberto was very much part of the local community, though, and as he worked as a farmer and acquired four farms in the Stellenbosch and Wellington areas over the years, he also became someone well-known and well-loved for his humanitarian work. Much of his work focused on Kayamandi, a suburb of Stellenbosch which was founded in the 1950s, to facilitate increased racial segregation under the apartheid regime. Over the years, Kayamandi has developed into a thriving community, but the scars of the past remain, and many of the most economically vulnerable residents in Stellenbosch live in Kayamandi. Alberto's work in the area usually included helping residents to start their own small businesses and creating bursaries to help the children of residents gain tertiary education. In Kayamandi, Alberto was known as Mtaliana, a nod to his Italian heritage, of course. Alberto was also deeply committed to his family. He and his wife Zelda had two children together, a son who was born in 2004 and a daughter who was born in 2009. The family lived on one of the farms they owned in Stellenbosch called Kluttersdal. There, and on his other farms, Alberto undertook mixed commercial farming of grapes, wine, eggs, stone fruit, cattle, and sheep. Zelda focused her energies on raising their children and wasn't really involved much in the farming business end of things. But in 2011, as she went about her role as a homemaker and mother, she could have no idea that very soon she would have no choice but to immediately and very deeply shift her focus to the farms. In 2011, rural properties, including farms and small holdings in the Western Cape, were not nearly as besieged by violent home invasions as similar properties in other provinces had been. But break-ins were not all that uncommon either. The farming community in Stellenbosch was grateful that they seemed to have somehow dodged the brutal trend sweeping through the rest of the country, but they were also not resting on their laurels and waiting to become victims either. Farmers and residents of other rural properties networked and worked together to ensure that they were able to assist one another with security and alert everyone when there were break-ins. Mostly the home invasions or house robberies in the area had been non-violent, but in 2010, a 47-year-old woman, Marion Hopkins, had been murdered in a house robbery in Stellenbosch, and the incident had served to push everyone in the area to up their security. A spate of robberies had occurred since then, with perpetrators mostly focusing on stripping pumps and motors for copper scrap they could sell. Local police would say they were seeing a pattern where several properties would be targeted on the same night or over a few nights in a row, and then there would be no incidents for a while until it started up again. Police weren't sure if it was the same gang committing all the crimes or a group of them, but they always seemed to be a step behind, and in all honesty, perhaps these crimes were not really that high on police's radar at the time. In my own experience, once police ascertain that you're insured and no one has been physically injured, they don't seem terribly interested in pursuing the cases after that. Of course, cases like these are difficult to solve, especially if the items taken aren't easy to identify in pawn shops or black market sale situations. It's only really once a home invasion turns violent that, in my experience at least, the case becomes a higher priority. But by then, for the victims, it's too late. And the surge in home invasions on rural properties in Stellenbosch was no different. And it was about to take a very violent and deadly turn. The Costa family had not been spared in the spate of break-ins in the area. Their home had been broken into in late 2010. The perpetrators had dug underneath the electric fence that surrounded the property and smashed a window. They'd rummaged through the front rooms before venturing into the hallway that led to the rest of the house, but it was there that they'd set off the house alarm and they'd fled without taking anything with them. When police arrived that day after being called, they found a smashed bottle of whiskey under the broken window and noticed blood on the shards of glass around the broken window pane, which they surmised had been from the robbers cutting themselves in their haste to escape as the house alarm screeched. The break-in had shaken the family, and after they'd cleaned up and had the window replaced, Alberto had increased security measures on the farm, although it was already a veritable fortress. One clear hole in the system had been the intruders being able to get to the house without anyone in the house knowing, and Alberto decided that if someone got past the electric fence, he wanted to know about it before they got into his house and set off the alarm inside, as they'd done on that occasion. So he installed motion detectors around the property that would pick up movement and set off an alarm inside the house to alert him if anyone was near it. Additional CCTV cameras were also installed around the property. In the early hours of Sunday, the 18th of February 2011, the new security system was put to the test for the first time. Around 2:35 a.m., an alarm went off inside the house, which indicated that the motion sensors outside had been activated. Alberto woke up immediately and woke his wife up, telling her to stay in the bedroom. He was going to check what was going on. As he spoke, he unlocked his gun safe, took out his shotgun, and loaded cartridges into it as he walked toward the front of the house. Alberto unlocked the veranda door and stepped onto it, scanning the yard for movement. In the meantime, the Costa's son had woken up and gone into his parents' bedroom. Zelda had decided to go with Alberto, and she told her son to stay in the bedroom. She found her husband standing on the veranda. As she neared him, Alberto saw movements near the portable braai, and he called out to the person to show themselves. Instead of the individual coming out, though, three gunshots were fired in Alberto's direction. Alberto managed to return one shot before leaning over on the veranda, initially propped up by his shotgun, and then collapsing face down. Zelda rushed over to her husband and asked whether he'd been shot. He didn't answer her, but the truth was clear when a pool of blood began to spread out around him. As Zelda kneeled beside her husband, she was aware of figures fleeing into the night off the property and into the darkness. In the next few minutes, Zelda Costa made several desperate calls, firstly to their tenant on the farm to alert him to the intruders in case he was at risk, and to tell him that Alberto had been shot, then to ADT security, who would in turn alert the police and ambulance, and her mother, who was a nurse. When the closest ADT security officer received a call, he immediately set out to the Costa's farm. Along the way, he saw a police car, flagged it down, and the officers followed him, with another two police cars joining in. Soon, the Kluttersdal farm was flooded with police officers, neighbours, security personnel, and paramedics. Unfortunately, when paramedics arrived, they declared Alberto dead. He had sustained significant damage from a gunshot wound to the chest and had lost too much blood to survive. Forensics officers arrived on the scene to start collecting evidence. A hole was discovered dug underneath the electric fence. Clearly, the same method of entrance had been used this time. The CCTV footage was also viewed, and it showed several figures moving across the property toward the house shortly before the motion sensor alarm had been triggered. The individuals were all wearing caps, so identifying them from CCTV would be difficult. The footage showed how one of the men had crouched down behind the portable braai when Alberto had appeared on the veranda with his gun raised, and how, after a few seconds, several shots were fired in Alberto's direction, and he managed to get one shot off before collapsing. The figures could then be seen moving off into the night. Forensic techs checked the portable braai area and saw blood on the floor around it. Clearly, Alberto had managed to hit one of the intruders. A call would be put out to all the hospitals in the area to ask that police be informed if anyone came in for a gunshot injury. The CCTV footage also helped techs to see where the men had stood and what they had touched, and this helped to secure several excellent quality fingerprints and DNA samples. Police also found items left behind by the fleeing intruders, including pieces of plastic pipe, a crowbar, a kitchen knife, a screwdriver, a shoe which appeared to have come off of one of the intruders as he fled, a cap, and several bullet casings on the veranda. Many of these items also yielded biological evidence. Seeing the blood and footprint trail leading out of the property, professional trackers were called in to assist the police in following the tracks left behind by the intruders. The trail led police through the vineyards on the farm. Along the way, they found another shoe and several drops of blood. The trail ended as the trackers neared Kayamandi, indicating that the intruders likely lived or operated from there. But no further progress was made that day. With so much biological and fingerprint evidence, police could get started by processing these pieces. Although the SAPS does have access to a database of fingerprints for convicted offenders, the quality of fingerprints and the possibility that an offender may not have made it into the database makes it a little hit or miss. The most powerful use of the biological evidence would be to compare it to an identified individual, and so the investigating officer on this case, Sergeant Marlon Apollos, still had his work cut out for him in old-fashioned detective work. The news of Alberto's murder spread through Stellenbosch, the rest of the country, and reached his family's motherland of Italy relatively quickly, and his wife and children received an outpouring of grief and condolences. Alberto had been such a helpful member of the community that now, with him gone, many wished to repay the kindness he'd shown them by dedicating themselves to his farms and his family. Farming is hard work, and there's something to be done almost every hour of the day. It's also very time-sensitive work, and jobs like harvesting cannot be left too long or the entire crop can be ruined. But the Stellenbosch farming community banded together and began helping to harvest grapes and arranging to sell surplus eggs so that nothing went to waste. Zelda, in a haze of grief and trying to be there for her children, would later express how grateful she had been for this assistance. Over the months and years that followed, she would apply her mind to learning about farming. But if it hadn't been for the help she'd received in those early days, her family's business may have suffered greatly without it. A 20,000 rand reward was offered for information which would lead to the men who had murdered Alberto. In many cases like this, a network of informants within communities are vital to police investigations. Very often, and thankfully, criminals find it difficult to keep their crimes to themselves. If they aren't making admissions to their girlfriends or bragging over several beers, they're trying to sell off items they've stolen, and this can lead to many more people knowing who was involved in what than just the core group. Sergeant Apollos had employed his network of informants several times in his career, and he suspected this would be one of the keys to solving Alberto's murder too. For almost 2 months, the case floundered, and every lead seemed to run cold. But then, on the 26th of April 2011, a doctor from a hospital near Stellenbosch called police to say he'd had a patient they may be interested in. The man had several pieces of metal lodged in his hand. He'd been unable to provide a clear explanation about how the injury had happened, and the doctor suspected it was shrapnel from a bullet. The patient's name was Simamkele Malaza. Before bringing the man in for questioning, Apollos looked into his background and found that the man had a pretty bad reputation in Kayamandi. He was essentially a vagrant and someone who was a known thief and regularly committed break-ins in spaza shops with a group of fellow criminals. Malaza's nickname was Shoes, because he'd had so many close calls during his break-ins and always seemed to escape in the nick of time. Malaza was brought in for questioning, and he denied any knowledge of Alberto's murder. He said he'd hurt his hand while operating sandblasting equipment. When Apollos asked for a sample of his DNA, Malaza agreed to supply it. 10 days later, the results were back, and it was confirmed that the blood on the scene belonged to Malaza. He was taken into custody and charged with Alberto Costa's murder. Even before these results had come back, though, Apollos figured that following the trail of Malaza's crimes in Kayamandi would lead him to more of the men who'd been in the group at the Costa's house that night. These follow-ups would lead to the arrest of two more men. In April, Vizicello Madolo, a general worker who had left school after completing grade 9 and lived in Kayamandi, was arrested. And in May, Cedric Mpakati was taken into custody. Mpakati was a convicted thief and was unemployed at the time. He'd been found guilty of theft in 2009 and given a suspended sentence. Both men were linked by sources in the Kayamandi community to Malaza and the crimes he committed regularly in the area. A fourth man was taken into custody after police officers interviewing the man, who had been found with an illegal firearm, thought to phone Apollos and see if he wanted to speak with him about Alberto's murder. Apollos found that the man, Mfundiso Yese, had an outstanding warrant from the Eastern Cape for a house robbery. When Yese realized that his number was up, and Apollos asked him outright if he knew anything about Alberto's murder, without much hesitation, Yese admitted that he had helped the men who had murdered Alberto to plan a break-in at the farm, but he insisted he hadn't been there that night. Yese was placed under arrest too, and fingerprints and DNA from all four men were submitted for comparison to the items found at the crime scene. In order to prove that the four men could be linked together and had a history of committing other similar crimes together, Apollos spent time tracking back what they had done in Kayamandi. He found that Malaza, Mpakati, and Madolo had committed several robberies together in the community. They would break in while people were sleeping, and Madolo would bring muti with him, which he burned, blowing the smoke under the door of the homes, in the belief that the muti would make the occupants sleep deeply so he and his cohorts could steal without them waking. During one break-in, they had stolen a gun, but the gun had no ammunition in it. Often when there are multiple accused involved in one case, police will try and get one of the accused to take a plea and testify against the others. Sometimes, if the individual didn't have much culpability in the crime, there'll be what's called a Section 204 witness. This means that the individual agrees to give evidence against his co-accused in exchange for immunity against prosecution if the judge accepts that their evidence is truthful. In other cases, an individual will be made an offer of a lesser sentence than they may have received in exchange for their testimony. Of course, one individual's testimony can never be the only evidence presented in court. That testimony has to match the set of facts and be supported by other evidence. In this case, Apollos had four accused, and after interviewing all of them and discussing it with the prosecutor, he decided that they would approach Madolo for a plea deal in exchange for his testimony. Madolo, Yese, Malaza, and Mpakati were all charged with both murder and attempted housebreaking with intent to rob. And Malaza had an additional charge of possession of an unlicensed firearm and ammunition. A deal was struck with Madolo, and on the 23rd of July 2012, his plea statement was read out in court. It revealed not just the fact that the four men had been present on the property on the night of Alberto's murder, but also gave insight into their actions in the months before the murder, which included the revelation that it had not been the first time they'd been on the property. Madolo revealed that the first break-in had been perpetrated by their group too. He said Yese had originally come up with the idea after seeing Alberto around Kayamandi and asking others about him. Madolo claimed that he told Yese twice that the idea wasn't a good one, but on the third occasion, when he'd brought it up, he'd agreed to participate. On the day of the first robbery, it had only been him and Yese present. His testimony matched the evidence that had been found that day. They'd dug under the electric fence and broken the window. They'd rummaged through the freezer, and Yese had placed a bottle of whiskey near the window, intending to take it with him when they left. But then they'd set off the house alarm, and they'd had to rush out, breaking the bottle as they did. They had also cut themselves on the window as they escaped. Madolo said that he'd been speaking with Mbakati a few days later and told him that they'd broken into Alberto's house, but it had all gone wrong. Mbakati said that they should go back with more people, but they had to wait a while because the family would increase their security measures after the break-in. Essentially, they had to wait until the Costas had dropped their guard again to strike for a second time. In the meantime, the group had continued with robberies in Kayamandi, and one of these would net them a weapon with ammunition. This would be the gun that would end up being used to kill Alberto. It also emerged in the statement that there was a fifth man involved who had been present on the night of the murder but had never been apprehended. The man's street name was Rax, but none of the men had known his real name, and he disappeared after the murder. Late on the evening of the 17th of February 2011, Madolo said, he, Malaza, Mbakati, and Rax had got together and decided they were going to hit the Costas' home again that night. They'd called Yese, and he said he was at work, but he would meet them later. Close to midnight, they'd all assembled. Malaza had a gun, Madolo a screwdriver, Yese a knife and a crowbar, Rax a pair of pliers, and Mbakati carried a bag for the loot they hoped to get from the robbery. The rest of Madolo's statement matched up with the evidence police already had around the crime. He confirmed that it had been Malaza who had shot Alberto and would eventually walk the court through the CCTV footage, frame by frame, explaining what had happened at each interval and identifying each figure on the screen. While Judge Robert Henney accepted Madolo's evidence as true, he made it known that he was hesitant to hand down the negotiated sentence, expressing that he felt it far too lenient, considering Madolo had been at the house twice and had more than enough time to change his mind and not participate, especially when a gun was brought into the mix, and he knew very well someone could lose their life. Ultimately, though, for the sake of the Costas and them being allowed to move on to the next portion of the trial and get justice for Alberto, he agreed and handed down 20 years for the murder and 8 years for housebreaking with intent to rob to Vizicello Madolo. Next up was the trial of the three remaining co-accused. All three men had pled not guilty to the charges against them, and so it was up to the prosecution to prove their guilt. In addition to the fingerprint, DNA and CCTV evidence, as well as Madolo's testimony, Mbakati's girlfriend testified for the prosecution, saying that her boyfriend had left with a group of men on the night of the 17th of February 2011 and only returned the following morning. When she'd asked him where they'd been, he told her that they'd robbed the Italian's house the night before and he had been shot. Zelda Costa also took the stand to testify to what had happened on the night she'd lost her husband. She also explained the impact that his murder had had on her and her children and said that her son had been too scared to live at the farmhouse and they'd since rented a property in town where he felt safer. The three accused did not have much of a defence to offer, other than to say it wasn't them, but Judge Henney disagreed. And on the 13th of September 2012, all three were convicted of all the charges against them. All three men were handed down life sentences for Alberto's murder, as well as 8 additional years each for the other charges. Malaza was also given another 6 years for the firearms charges. Although the men had tried to claim in mitigation of their sentences that the shooting of Alberto was accidental and they hadn't gone there to kill him, Judge Henney said that there was nothing accidental about Alberto's death. The men had, out of pure greed, decided to target the Costa family, not once, but twice. And on both occasions, they'd taken weapons with them. But on the second occasion, being armed with a gun, even for those men who had not held the firearm, this elevated their crime to another level, as they knew very well that there was a good possibility they would not get in and out without being seen, and they had been prepared to shoot anyone who tried to stop them. On the courtroom steps, Zelda Costa told journalists that she held no desire for revenge against the men who had killed her husband. She said that although the convictions brought a sense of closure to one part of their story, there were no winners. She knew that the men would never truly understand how much damage they had done to many, many lives when they'd killed Alberto. In parting, she said that she was glad that, at least, she could go home that day and tell her children that they didn't need to be scared anymore, because the bad men who had killed Daddy were locked away. Over the years, Zelda and Alberto's names have come up a few times in court records, as Zelda took the helm of the family's farming interests and attempted to navigate the legalities behind that. The men responsible for Alberto's murder, except for Madolo, will be eligible for parole in 2036. Madolo would have already been eligible for parole and may have already been released. Although the men may not have gone to the farm that night with the intention of killing anyone, you don't break into a house in the middle of the night knowing that the occupants are home and come armed with a gun and other weapons and not have some expectation of violence. Especially when you know the occupants of the home are likely armed themselves. And for what? What might they have thought they would find in Alberto's home that night that could make it worthwhile for them to take that risk? Twice. Guns? Meat from a freezer? Alcohol? A bit of cash? It seems so nonsensical to most of us. So absolutely pointless. But that hasn't stopped these types of crimes from happening over and again since then. Something that bugged me about this case was how these men were known criminals within Kayamandi. They had been terrorizing the residents there for years. And yet, their crimes there were never taken seriously. They were never arrested or prosecuted. And perhaps many of the victims didn't even report them. Perhaps thinking, what's the point? And for me, this is the point. When we as citizens don't report, and more pointedly, the SAPS fails to take so-called minor crimes seriously, this is what happens. People lose their lives. Because if I can commit so many robberies and get away with it, why would I not continue doing that? And why would I not escalate if the stakes seemed higher and I could get a bigger haul? And once I get my hands on a gun, all bets are off. I'm grateful for the Costa family
that the bad men who killed Daddy were put away. So few families get that element of closure. But sadly, it's a false sense of safety. Because those bad men were just men once, before they became bad. And there are many, many more out there, ready and willing to do exactly what they did. Alberto Costa, rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.